This is Deanna Spingola. It is Thursday, September 13th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is Bare Bones Broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are VeraIconaPublishers.org and YouTube.com/VeraIcona100. She is the author of many, many books, including Black Nazis, A Study of Racial Ambivalence in Nazi Germany's Military Establishment, and Black Nazis II, Ethnic Minorities and Foreigners in Hitler's Armed Forces, The Unbiased History. I think I've run these two together. Veronica is also the translator and editor of Werewolves of the Iron Cross, The Hyenas of High Finance, which is a fabulous book, and Hitler and Himmler Uncensored. And you've got some new ones coming up real quick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the next one in the Werewolf series is Albion and Zion United, and this is going to be the first book where the terms Jutsies, Britsies, and Yankees are introduced formally into our dialogue, because it's time. It may be silly to some, but I think Nazi is silly, and we've been using that in a scholastic environment since, you know, even before World War II started. So it's time to apply the same immaturity to the Allied side.
Oh, definitely.
And this
is wonderful.
Yeah, and this book is going to have, I did get a book from that OD43 site I showed you a long time ago. He has all that Third Reich stuff.
Oh, right.
I got a book on the Polish atrocities against the Germans. Many of those pictures are going to go into this next one. They're stunning. Nobody who sees these pictures is going to be able to condemn Hitler for his invasion and anger at Poland. Let's put it that way. I mean, they're unbelievable in their grotesque qualities. Right. And most of these have not, in fact, been published before. This was a book put out by the Reich to kind of clear up the whole, anti-Polish campaign in 1939. And basically, the Germans are justifying their case against Poland. And this, you know, the massacres were only one small part of the whole puzzle, as you know, but the pictures just speak far more words than any person can write in text.
Right.
So those are going to be included. And there was an English edition of this put out, but it probably had such little reception, if anyone even knew about it.
I think I have a PDF file of that book, but I do not remember that it has any pictures in it. What's the name of it? Polish Atrocities Against the Germans?
Now, this one is in German. It's Die Polnischen Gräueltaten an den Volksdeutschen in Polen. So it's probably going to be something like Polish Atrocities Against the German People in English.
Okay.
I got the German edition, but it's stunning. Even I was like floored. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. So it really makes the case for Hitler. Poles were never treated like they treated Germans.
Oh, no.
Just weren't. And I'm sorry, but the propaganda and the silly communist arguments aren't cutting the cheesecake. So, sorry, Poland, but most of your propaganda against Germans was from communists, unfortunately.
Right. And, of course, they believed it.
Right.
Polish people believed it. And of course, you'd want to believe the best about your people, because that's just the way it works. Nobody wants to know that that their people are brutal. And in fact, even Americans, well, particularly Americans, would never want to believe some of the stuff that we have done in other countries and how we've treated other people. I mean, it's just... And yet, the evidence is remarkable for in several countries.
Right. It's difficult to convince an American that they're really the terrorists and the tyranny.
Yeah.
But it's so true. And it just, the more I study and the more I see what we're doing today, the more it's so overwhelming. And you just, you just have to get enlightened to it. And if you don't, I'm sorry for you, but, you know, fortunately the folks around RBN and stuff are, they're one of the small lights out in this sea of darkness.
Okay.
It seems to be picking up, thank goodness. But yeah, people are starting to see America as it really is, kind of from the perspective of other peoples.
Right.
And that's kind of what we're going to deal with today with this Operation Wetback, which most Americans have never heard of.
Right. I do. I just brought this book up. It's called The Polish Atrocities Against the German Minority in Poland. It was edited and published by the Order of the Foreign Office and based upon documentary evidence. And it was published in Berlin in 1940 by Hans Schadewalt.
That is it. And
Ooh.
Yours doesn't have pictures then?
It's a PDF file. And it just does not have any pictures.
Maybe the person, did the somebody scan it in as a
probably,
PDF?
Probably, yes.
They probably didn't want to sit there putting all the, it's a lot of work, scanning
all
those pictures.
No,
but
no
I'll make
pictures.
Sure they're in, they're going to be in the next book. So, yeah, and that will be good. All right.
All righty.
So we can go ahead and start. The only book I could find on this Operation Wetback was by Juan Ramon Garcia, and it's called The Mass Deportation of Mexican Undocumented Workers in 1954. It's an ex-library book, Greenwood Press. They're always a fortune. I don't know why Greenwood charges like $200 and $300 for a new book, but they do. This is published in 1980. So basically, it wasn't just in 1954 that we had mass roundups where we were literally taking these people wherever we found them and dropping them off as far into the Mexican interior as we could reach with nothing. They were left with no food, no water, nothing. It's just drop them off and good luck to you. If they had any property in the United States during the 1930s roundings up, and deportations, they didn't get to take it with them. And a lot of the growers, and one cannot underestimate the power of the growers, especially the ones in Texas. They were inhuman beasts. I'm sorry, Texans, but your history is pretty bad with respect to this whole agribusiness thing, unfortunately. And I don't know if it's still like that today, but I mean, these people would, if they could, not pay these braceros who were brought in under this bracero program. They wouldn't pay them if they didn't have to. So these guys would work a full term under this bracero agreement that they contracted to. And so did the grower. And then at the end of it, if they were, you know, caught up in the mass deportation because Americans suddenly decided they didn't want Mexicans anymore, they didn't get paid.
Oh, my goodness.
Right.
Well, I know that there was a situation after the war started, after Pearl Harbor, that all of the people that were, all of the Japanese Americans that were rounded up, about 110,000 of them, 80,000 of whom had been born in this country, were rounded up because, and mostly in California, because the California growers wanted to get rid of them. And and have their property confiscated because they worked for less money and also charged less money for their produce.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, it's the growers.
Mm-hmm. And the growers always screamed, we don't have labor. We have a labor shortage. We can't get domestic laborers or, you know, citizens to do anything. They're not around. That's a lie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lie today. It was a lie then. No grower. What you can't do is pay someone below minimum wage, essentially having slaves in this country, and not have complaints and union blowback and people boycotting and protesting it. That's what you can't have. You can't be basically a greedy swine. So, you know, they were always lobbying the government and threatening congressmen and going, if you can't bring us quote unquote wetbacks, we're not going to have cotton. You want to starve? I mean, they were always threatening and, you know, acting like these immature just way too rich people.
Right.
And they just basically saw Mexicans as inhuman. They really did.
Well, so same thing with the Chinese who built the railroad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, one congressman commented that, and this was, you know, widely shared by many American congressmen and other officials, was that Mexicans were treated worse than slaves back in the slave days, because a slave as a piece of property owned by somebody who had a vested interest in their well-being took better care of those slaves as quote-unquote property than they did quote-unquote wetbacks, because who needs to take care of these Mexicans? They need to go find their own food and whatever.
Right.
Now, people have to understand that under this Bracero agreement, and this went on for like, I think the Bracero program started in, it was either the 1930s or the early 1940s it officially started. Now, we already brought over Mexican workers to come work during the war and whatnot, and then, you know, rounded them up and threw them out when we decided we didn't want them anymore during World War II. So while everybody was screaming and raging about the Jewish emigration plan, which was far more humane in comparison, we were doing the same thing, but worse, more inhuman. You know, and why do we not see this? Either, you know, we didn't see it then and we don't see it today. Now, some groups did, but they just didn't have enough clout. So, you know, of course, this has been whitewashed or completely ignored from our history. And anyone who brings it up might be considered, you know, a liberal saboteur or whatever. But no, it's just a case of being humanitarian towards your fellow man, regardless of what race they are.
And so you're comparing this against the transfer agreement in Germany.
Exactly. And specifically Ingrid Weckert's account, Jewish Emigration from the Third Reich. Now, Rolf Vogel, who's Jewish, wrote his own account of the transfer agreement. And even he couldn't get around, in spite of his nonsense about the extermination and the 6 million, when all of his evidence in his whole presentation contradicts that, as well as Edwin Black, another Jew, whose family basically disowned him, but then took him back, you know, because they realized his book, The Transfer Agreement, was real, and it really did happen, and he wasn't lying and trying to, quote unquote, whitewash the, you know, the NSDAP. He's another guy who, in spite of what he blabs about the extermination and the Holocaust, etc., can't get around the fact that Hitler was really the driving force behind this emigration plan, and he, Schacht and Goering, and of course Heydrich, who was, you know, kind of put in charge of this whole Wannsee Protocol deal, where they talked about the final solution, which was, you know, the removal of all Jews eventually. They were all the real pushers behind the emigration. So how do you have them as the main characters behind emigration, spending all this money and time at great expense to the German government, in fact, when they were, you know, short on foreign currency, had boycotts against the worldwide. In fact, Palestine bit the hand that fed them and ended up, you know, with these Jews that were, you know, eventually repatriated there. Throwing the Germans back out and whining about how they had too much like German competition against the local native Palestinian Jews that were already there. So this whole thing was hurting the Reich. How do you make that fit with the Holocaust? You can't. Indeed. And then Ingrid makes a really good point. She goes, look, if Edwin Black is furious about the emigration, that doesn't make sense when he says that every Jew that had to stay in Germany ended up being gassed.
Right.
He's not making sense.
But now his other book about IBM, maybe that got him back in the good graces of his family.
Right. And that's more nonsense, because IBM was just installing punch card systems to have the alleged slave labor that was paid in concentration camp scrip so that they could go buy goods and stuff that they needed, so that they could punch in and out. Now, who has their slave labor force punching in and out on time cards?
Exactly.
Does not make sense. He knows it. He has to know that. Sorry, but the Gulag did not have IBM punch cards.
No, and they didn't bother to put numbers on their prisoners, because why would you put numbers on people if you were going to just kill them?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, so we got that dealt with. So let me just go through some of the main points here. This author, Juan Garcia, he describes the growers in Texas as literally a fifth column that hurt all citizens of the United States. Didn't matter if you were a Mexican-American, a Japanese-American, or an Anglo-American, they were hurting you in some way. They were either exploiting you or not giving you good jobs or costing you money, tax money, through their endless whining for foreign slave labor. Again, he compares the racism and the pay or the non-pay that these Mexicans received to the slave system of early America. And it really was. These people were they were talked down to. They were treated like absolute dirt by these growers. And they literally had these Mexican men living in like dirt hovels. A lot of times they were sleeping outside. They didn't even provide them with bunks. Now, that's not all the growers, but it was mostly in the Rio Grande Valley and mostly in Texas where the situation was really, really bad. Now, this would be reminiscent of one of the death camps of Germany that we always heard about. That's how these people were living. And of course, disease was rampant, and a lot of these Mexicans died right there in these hideous conditions or during the deportations. Lots of them died. But of course, nobody kept track. They just, you know, plop across, down, you know, didn't know the names or anything unless family knew them and knew, you know, where they were at any given time. So, you know, is this really what happened during the transfer agreement with the Jews, who were allowed to take all of their property, transfer all their wealth except their actual physical home and their physical land to their new homeland? They were given special bank accounts through Jewish banks, Wasserman, and what was the other one? I think it was a Warburg Bank and Wasserman, two private Jewish banks that were allowed to exist under Hitler. They were only for Jews, though. People need to understand that the existence of these banks was condoned as long as only Jews conducted business there. So it was separate from the German people in the German banks and the German banking system. They were two completely private banks. These Jews were allowed to place their funds if they sold a home or property or a business or transferred it. And this all went almost completely peacefully. All these transfers of their businesses, sales, there was very little exploitation on the part of Germans during this process. And those Germans who were exploiting were fined and sometimes jailed by the Reich government for exploiting these Jewish people under, you know, undergoing this process for emigration. Hitler had no tolerance for that kind of shenanigans. So they placed their monies, etc., with these banks, and then the banks then forwarded that money to their new homeland when they arrived. And the Germans worked out a system with Schacht, who's, you know, allegedly the Rothschild agent. Now, I mean, Schacht had he answered to the Bank of England a little bit, as we know, but he also did a lot of things right by the Reich for quite a while until he was finally, you know, ousted. But he worked out this plan amidst all this resistance, all these boycotts, all the difficulties, which are really difficult to, you know, just explain in a short radio program. There were so many roadblocks against Germany that he really had to pull strings and really stretch himself to come up with this plan. But he was able to get even poor Jews eligible for emigration for just £500. And Jews who were more well off, and in Ingrid prints out like the income divisions, like A, B, C, D, E, F, whatever category you fell into as a Jew who was emigrating. And they made sure that you could emigrate no matter what. They'd even give you a loan that you paid back later once you were in your homeland if you couldn't afford the full cost. But it was generally around just £1,000. And the Palestine pound, since it was under British mandate at the time, was equivalent to the pound sterling. So you're talking about, you know, approximately $1,000 or $500 if you're poor. There were even some cases where people like youth didn't have to pay anything. They were sponsored by, you know, older Jews who wanted their talent. And here's the thing. The SS and the Gestapo set up training camps. It was either 30 or 50 of them, which have probably been described as death or concentration camps today. They were just training camps to train the Jews in different trades so that when they went to Palestine or their new homeland, they were desirable because now they had a skill, like in machining or woodwork or, you know, motor vehicle repair. This was sponsored and paid for by the SS and the Gestapo. The Gestapo even paid for part of the ship costs. So when the ships sailed to Palestine with their Jewish emigrants, the Gestapo paid for some of that expense. So, you know, this whole idea that the Jews couldn't get out of Germany, they were so mistreated, it was nothing but horror. You know, everyone was sneaking around, having to crawl through bushes and barely get across the border. It is 100% fantasy. The people that were really doing that and were in fear constantly were the Mexicans, who had these mixed messages coming from the U.S. government from year to year. We need you desperately. They'd even open like recruit, like, you know, Bracero recruiting centers along the border, desperate for these Bracero Mexicans to come over and pick the harvests. And then the next year, get out. We're arresting you and fining you if you're caught here. How are people supposed to respond to this? It's a schizophrenic nation as far as its immigration policy. And Garcia really gets to the core of that. And, you know, anyone would be completely confused.
Oh, absolutely. So
those were the people who were really not knowing what was going to happen next. Hitler was very consistent. And let me just read, like, just this one little part at the bottom of 131. Where Garcia says the Border Patrol, like any other government agency whose work is of direct interest to various groups, is sensitive to the political configuration of a given time. Now, this is something people have got to understand. It doesn't matter what government you have. The churches, the agencies under the government have to be coordinated to whatever government comes into power. So everyone goes, oh, the horror of Hitler's Gleichschaltung, his coordination, if you will, where everything was quote-unquote Nazified. Has not everything here been liberalized, democratized, globalized, multiculturalized? I mean, please, we all know that when a government gets into power, it starts extending its tentacles into the agencies below it. It gets into education and starts the new foundation of whatever is the values of that government. And one would hope it's a reflection of the people and what they want. In our case, not so much, because what we see constantly is the people voting and voting for and saying one thing and our government doing quite the other. In Hitler's case, the people and the NSDAP agreed almost all the time, and he made sure of that. Now, Hitler created the context of you Jews are going to start feeling the pressure, and it was not meant to scare them and terrorize them, etc. The idea was, this is a new German people, it's a new government, we have new values, etc., that are going to start extending out. You people need to feel the pressure of this new way. And that pressure was exerted to try to encourage them to leave. So the real modus behind the initial quote-unquote anti-Semitism was to get the Jews to leave of their own accord. We did the same thing prior to Operation Wetback. There was, in 1954, just before the actual physical operation took place under Eisenhower, a climate of pressure created in the media. There were warnings put out to all the growers. I mean, this stuff was publicized everywhere. There were signs in Spanish along the bus routes, etc., to let the Mexicans know, your time is up. It's coming. And so this whole media blitz, if you will, was created to pressure them to leave voluntarily. And tens of thousands did. The INS claimed that it was almost 50,000 that left of their own accord, for sure, that they could count. So it's the same idea. We did the same thing that Germany did. But we're cool, we're okay, we're wonderful, we're just defending our democratic liberal interests, and Hitler is a genocidal maniac and hater.
Well, also, we have to remember that in the spring of 1933, international Jewry declared economic warfare on Germany. Now, the Mexicans who came to work because the farmers, the growers wanted them to come and they wanted cheap labor. They certainly didn't make any kinds of threats. And yet we treated the U.S. government treated them like that, as opposed to Hitler and his response and his assistance in helping the Jews leave. He wasn't certainly didn't treat them anything like the American government treated the Mexicans.
Exactly. And according to Ingrid Veckert, her first footnote in Jewish Emigration from the Third Reich, there was actually a whole series of such declarations of war. And her source is Hartmut Stern, Jüdische Kriegserklärungen an Deutschland, Jewish declarations of war, not just declaration on Germany. So this was not just an isolated thing, and it did hurt Germany. And we must remember, Hitler's faced with not 6 million unemployed, but Richard Overy's figure of 8 million unemployed. It was not 6 million, it was 8 million. And there were 17 million unemployed Germans over the winter of, I believe it was 32 to 33, just before Hitler comes in. Now, that's because it was seasonal. But can one fathom 17 million unemployed over a winter season just coming into office? And these Jews go, we hate you, Hitler Germany, we're declaring war on you. We hope you fail. I mean, he was super nice, super nice to them, because he even waited to start cracking down.
And many of these Jews had not lived in the country for decades and decades. A lot of them were newly arrived from the East within a short period of time during the Weimar Republic and after World War I.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. And just a few questions that Garcia asks that are important because they also relate to the Jews in Germany. Let's think about these questions and whether they apply to the Jews in Germany at the time. He asks about the people who were opponents of illegals. And this applies to today, too. Was the concern expressed by opponents of the illegals based on the exploitation of these people? Was it based on a desire to identify and hopefully solve some of the social ills plaguing the country? So in other words, were we blaming illegals, but really concerned about the social decay and the economic problems created by our government and these Jewish greedmongers in power at the time? That to me is a case of scapegoating, and it's very cleverly done by our government and supported by our government when they need to open that release valve and get people to blow off some steam. They like to go after the illegals and play up the border patrol, and this happens all the time. So let's think about that too. Are we accidentally scapegoating these people when we really should be going after somebody completely different? And was it the desire of anti-wetback groups to attach an onus to anyone who employed or smuggled illegals by emphasizing and perhaps exaggerating the ills created by the illegal influx? Or was it a combination of these things? So, you know, I think we all recognize that illegal immigration is a problem, but why? Is it really the illegals we should be blaming because they're trying to, you know, make a better life for themselves? Mexico's, it's worse than it was. It's worse now than it was then, unbelievably.
Right.
But, you know, are they really the ones we should be targeting and dehumanizing and exploiting, etc., when it's the leadership in this country and the mixed messages they're always sending and these growers who are, you know, insatiable greed, as far as I'm concerned, on the part of many of them, who stomp on their own fellow small farmers who are trying to do right by their citizens and hire them? Is it them that we're really angry at? And why is it that we go after the illegals when those bigger interests need to be taken down? Because it's easier.
Sure. And of course, the Mexicans would not be coming north to get a job if the international bankers hadn't destroyed their economy in the mid-1990s.
Exactly. And one will even notice, I have a Dodge Ram, and apparently all these Rams from the 90s were made in Mexico. Great truck. Haven't had one single problem with it. They're some of the best trucks ever made from Chrysler Corporation. That's no more. They're no longer made in Mexico. All those Mexican jobs went to China, India, back to Canada because of pressure from Canada, or back to the United States in certain states that don't have union protection. So, yes, indeed. What happened there? First, we had this big deal about how we were going to help Mexico and create jobs there and have, you know, freer trade between the two countries, which I actually earnestly believe would help both of our countries. It would make travel easier. It would make spending on both sides better. You wouldn't have the incredible drug trade going on. I mean, that just wouldn't be allowed anymore. The CIA wouldn't be allowed to do its little shenanigans there. So what happened there? That's a good question.
Right. Of course, the free trade agreements were designed to look really, really humanitarian, and it was going to benefit mm-hmm. both sides, when in fact, it was only going to benefit the multinational corporations who were looking for cheap labor and the outsourcing of production from this country. So it was...
Exactly. Yep. It went from... Basically, it was the South who were initially exploited. Then it became Mexico and other foreign countries, and now we are exploiting, or our corporations are exploiting Asians, Indians, and apparently China just isn't cheap enough anymore because their people don't want to be treated like animals. And so now they're thinking about going to, was it Malaysia? They're trying to undercut even China. Now, at some point, these corporations must be stopped. And, you know, just recently, mind you, these corporations are part of the immigration problem. They're probably, them and the growers are part of the biggest problem of immigration, period. Right. Nobody would leave their homeland if they had a good economy. And, you know, the top level governments and their corporations didn't come in and destroy everyone's country and come exploit them so that they would go to the first world nations to escape these horrors.
Right.
You know, we got Americans that want to leave America now because it's becoming
indeed.
And that was unprecedented.
And it's really the big growers. It's not the little, the independent farmers. Just you brought up the South. It was the big plantation owners that were calling the shots. It wasn't the independent farmers. And so it's always been, and now you can compare those to the factory farms.
Exactly. And Garcia makes that real clear. He said there were the small growers and many, many of the more northern growers. It was really California, Arizona, and Texas that were the worst perpetrators. These other growers tried to do right. They always used the Bracero program and hired those workers who were just temporary and would go back to Mexico. They tried to, you know, pay them right, gave them their insurance under the contract, their medical care under the contract. The other growers, now what they did is they said, you take your Bracero agreement, Mr. Government, and, you know, cram it. We're going to just hire illegals. They referred to them as wetbacks. And that's how they did it. And these agribusinesses just told the government, you have no power. We own the congressmen here. We own this place. I mean, that's really how these Rio Grande growers acted.
Sure.
And they were strutting their stuff and they got away with whatever they wanted. And everyone, you know, the Border Patrol couldn't do their job. And I guess most Americans don't understand the kind of pressure that these big organized lobbies, even if they're not that populous, it's the money and just the loud mouths they have and the insatiable greed is such a motivator for them. And they're almost unstoppable. Now, the one thing, and I just want to bring in that comment, I was on a forum and I'm not going to name the name because I don't want to pick on people and that's not what I'm doing. But this person who's very intelligent and kind of trying to get the truth about Hitler points out, okay, I get the whole Hitler was not an exterminator, that, you know, the Holocaust is a hoax, you know, he wasn't an Illuminist or whatever and not a Rothschild agent. But why would you want a government like his? Why would you want a fascist government? Isn't that what we have now? And this is where I'm going to bring this in now. A fascist government is the only government pretty much out there that will create jobs and that will, that can summon the force, if you will, to bring these corporations and these growers to heel. Hitler was a strong man, and what he did is he transferred the power in a very subversive and clever way from the corporations to the government. And that's why everyone is so upset about, oh, the government of Germany had so much power. Oh, it could decide life and death. Our government can decide life and death, too. Any government can if it really wants to. The question is, would you rather have a government that can bring corporations to heel and give you a job and give you security and give you national health care and take care of nearly all of its citizens, minus maybe half to 1% who just won't engage in, you know, civilization? Or would you rather have what we have now in America?
Right.
That's how I would pose it.
Now, was it a fascist government or was it a national socialist government?
And that's another thing. There are similarities shared between fascism and national socialism, but Hitler's establishment was a little different because he basically, he completely reconceptualized the state. And this is how I put it to my mom, because I test on her before I go on a radio program. Hitler saw the state in a new role as basically the master father of the whole people. So if you see the state as your overall caretaker, that it is part and parcel of the race and the people, the folk, it takes on a whole different way of how we see the state and how the state sees us. If your state does not see you as special because of your racial traits, your cultural traits, you as a unique people, then what do you have? You have nothing. You have what we have in America, in the EU, in Britain, You got people lost and flailing everywhere. You got every race, you know, trying to find an identity in a sea of madness. The state is nothing but an exploiter of all. Simply
exactly.
For a private cabal that does take care of itself and its race above all. And I, you know, I put it to my mom this way too, because she goes, are you sure it's just the Jews? You know, because I see that there's other people that are corrupt, etc. And we go back and forth on this a little bit. And I said, this is how I'd put it. Most peoples can be made to care about other peoples enough so that they would actually take foreign children in or go into a foreign country and help simply out of like altruism. Jews don't do that. Jews come first. Jews above all. Jews only take, quote unquote, take care of others to exploit them and make it better for Jews. That's what sets Jews apart, in my view.
I would have to agree. And in my research, and last week I had Vaccine Awareness Week, mm-hmm. and so I looked up the background of one of the organizations, the American Academy of Pediatrics, to see how they came about, what their history was, because they are the ones that devise the immunization schedules, which are basically biological warfare against people. And right. So I did this little study on their background and discovered that, and it was not surprising to me, discovered that it was a Jew by the name of Rosenberg, I believe, that devised this organization back in 1929. And certainly there were other people who joined him, but it was based on his ideology and the other people who there were 34 other people who created this organization. But the ideology is always the Jewish ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always based on profit. It's a profit model, because when they they view people as ways of making money.
Exactly. There's no other way to put it. And other people have a little bit of that penchant, yes, but it's not like permeating all the way up and down the structure and culture. It's not like an inherent trait. And we do feel guilty about bad things we do. We do empathize, and we do have altruistic behavior towards other races that are different from us. And this just doesn't exist in the Jews.
And if you look at the immigration policy, and who devised the immigration policy, I'm afraid you're going to find the same group of people.
Right. Now, what's interesting is I did find in the Garcia book that there was a Lehman who opposed letting illegals in here, and he supported bolstering the Border Patrol. But again, was it because he was protecting Jewish interests or some kind of profit interest of his own? That I'd have to look into, but it would be interesting to find out what his motive was. A lot of times their motive will also be quote unquote humanitarian, but it's only it's like what the ADL does. We're anti-defamation. We hate racism. We care about Mexicans. We care about Africans. We're always at the forefront of protecting their rights. No.
Right.
Anyone can cut through that lie. The ADL is the... they're just... I can't even go there. It's so absurd and it's so ludicrous the way they present everything.
All right.
They basically want you to think that all whites are evil and, you know, they have to change to make the world a better place. And that's all that has to happen to make the world a better place. And it's like, excuse me, it was certain Northwestern Europeans who did any of this domination and slavery in the first place. And secondly, we've changed quite a bit just because of trends over the many decades. Quit going back to 1920 in your arguments.
Mm-hmm.
They always do that. They have to build from the past up to bring those old resentments back up in these other groups.
Right. And of course, the reason that they are so fond of these other groups is because they want to lead them and manipulate them and exploit them.
Right.
And they can only do that if they are in control of them.
Exactly.
And they say they are against hate speech, but they are only against hate speech that targets them. One
right.
can go to any, all these websites that talk terrible about all these other groups of people. Well,
mm-hmm.
They're very selectively, you know, they only select who they're going to target if they happen to be speech against the Jews.
Right. Yeah, they don't go after any other hate, quote unquote, hate speech.
No.
Yeah. It's obvious to me how they are exploiting, and they're so misleading. All I had to do was read Abe Foxman's introduction to Mein Kampf, and it was like, oh, I tore it out.
And that was in which edition?
It's in the Mannheim edition.
Right.
I tore it out of there. So my Mannheim edition is slaughtered. It's got notes all over in it and stuff, but it's Mannheim.
Right.
You know, he's a vulgar translator too.
Terrible.
Like I said, I would recommend the Ford edition, far more accurate as far as terminology, not perfect, but more accurate.
Right.
Also, real quick, you know, a lot of people today always, you know, talk about police state tactics in America. Oh, we're increasingly a police state, especially that economic collapse blog.
Mm-hmm.
No. Police state raids were conducted against minorities and Mexicans all the time. If you were not white in this country, you knew the meaning of police state. So that's just a non-argument there. Depending on what race you were, No. America's always been a police state. And now it's just being applied to whites, too. That's what I contend. And he has it in this book. It's just, they were going around busting into private homes without warrants, grabbing people off the street, you know, search and seizure wherever you were. There was no warrant. There was no reading anybody's rights. Mm-mm. The government decided it was time for you to go, and you were a Mexican. We're checking you out, and get out.
Well, they even used that with regard to the Bonus Army in 1932
mm-hmm.
Against veterans.
Right.
That group of people, I can't remember the total number, but those were people who had participated in World War I and were now destitute, and yet they took after them with guns and kill several of them.
Exactly.
And that was their own people. People who supposedly should have been thanked and given their bonus. But
mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely.
Or there's been other groups. The Ludlow Massacre and the Pullman riot, where the police have gone after certain groups because they refuse to work under certain conditions.
Right.
So, yeah.
The Zoot Suit Riots, they blame that on the Mexicans. No, the police started it.
Right.
The U.S. police started the Zoot Suit Riots during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another case of a small racial war and terrorization of citizens in the United States during World War II, when we were supposedly fighting for minority rights, fighting to end racism,
right.
et cetera. Just nonsense.
Exactly.
I think the real question Americans have to ask themselves is how their government gets them to fight for strictly moral reasons. Every U.S. soldier and veteran needs to ask themselves, why do I fight for moral reasons alone?
Oh, they always use these atrocity stories.
Right. But why do we do it? I mean, obviously, there's some altruism at work there.
Sure.
If we don't really care about other people, we're not going to go fight for moral reasons. But we really need to question that basis for warfare. You're also massacring and killing and upsetting millions of lives by going and fighting for your moral need, your internal moral need, soldier.
Right.
You know, they need to understand that. Are they satisfying their moral need inside? You know, at what expense
right.
are you satisfying that moral need of yours?
Well, I think that a lot of people are beginning to wake up. A lot of people that are in Afghanistan and Iraq,
mm-hmm.
The suicide rate is really high. Of course, they
keep
them on a lot of a lot of drugs, and they use them as guinea pigs for their vaccine program. I mean, it's just, it's a terrible thing. But I think that they do use, they appeal to patriotism, they appeal to so many things. And of course, most of these people have grown up in the government schools, where they pledge allegiance to the government, where they are totally obedience trained, and they're trained to believe everything the government says. And they use music and all kinds of things. Well, they use sports. I mean, it's embedded, excuse me, it's embedded in sports. And I mean, you can't go to a game, not that I've ever been to a game, where they don't pledge, where they sing the national anthem, and they have all this marching music, and it's embedded in the religious services. Even before the so-called Civil War, they had songs that were designed to mix militarism with Christianity.
And I think that's one of the reasons Americans don't like the German war effort of beginning in 1939, because Hitler did not deceive his people. He did not sell his war as a moral war of liberation of any peoples. He said, this is a war of self-preservation of us and Europe, who are going to be destroyed by this liberal communistic Britzy disease that's coming in from every side. And I mean, Britain was just as much a threat as the USSR against Europe's interests.
Sure.
So, you know, he didn't try to sell his war as a moral war. And I think that irritates Americans. They go, no, no, no. You can't have a war for, you know, material interests, or, you know, to get territory back or to secure your citizens. No, you can't. It's got to be moral. You got to go liberate someone or do it for God.
Sure.
No. No, you don't. No war is ever done that way. It may be sold and packaged that way, but that's not what it is at the top. And we need to understand that.
Right.
You know, real quick, this S-3660 and 3661, these bills, this legislation that was basically supposed to fine anyone who hired illegals knowingly. Okay, we've been here before. This came back recently, in fact, fine the employers. This was inevitably going to be shot down by the growers' congressmen. So what the government did is they implemented Operation Wetback to lull those who would support such legislation against these vicious growers and other industrial employers of illegals for slave wages. Into a sense of, we're doing something about it. That's why they implemented Operation Wetback, to kind of buy some time and, you know, open that valve and let off some steam, America. We're taking care of it. We were deceived, and a lot of people suffered. So it's, you know, the same kind of idiocy that continues to come up. Now, Attorney General Brownell interviewed over 100 people in Southern California to get the idea of the costs of illegal immigration. And, you know, what they come up with is just, it's crazy. Basically, I already have a solution to the whole thing just from reading this part of his book. The taxpayers are already paying to subsidize these people. They are coming in this country. If you do not have a national socialist government, regardless of what you say or do, America, nothing you do or say is going to tell our government not to bring in illegals to undercut and to work as slaves. So accept it. You're already subsidizing them. You're paying for their medical. You're paying for their dental. You're paying for their kids' education, etc. You're already paying. So why don't the taxpayers just subsidize their pay, their hourly pay, where the government gives them half and the growers give them half? That way you satisfy these interest groups, the agribusinesses, and you say, all right, you're going to pay what, like, let's just say $3, and we're going to pay $3 an hour under this contract agreement, like the Bracero agreement. They're going to temporarily come over, legal. We're going to streamline the process so you don't have to complain endlessly about how hard it is to sign up legal citizens in a contract program that's temporary. That way they get paid, and they can take it back home and go back to Mexico. Illegal problem solved. You're already subsidizing them. You might as well pay half their hourly salary under a legal contract. That way they're not going to stay and try to get automatic citizenship. So he just kind of talks about these astronomical costs of bringing in all these people illegally that we, the people, are paying for, while the agribusinesses are, you know, in these corporations that employ them aren't paying. They're not footing the bill.
No.
The government is, which is us.
Yes.
So there you have it. I mean, another case where, you know, this immigration thing easily solved. The fascist and national socialist countries didn't have immigration problems. Why is that?
And they had foreign workers.
They sure did. Hitler had 8 million. 8 million. Several million Poles, too, who tried to say that they were slaves after the war. No, they weren't. The Poles were bringing over friends and stuff illegally. Germany did have an illegal immigration problem during the war, because what was happening is everyone in Eastern Europe and Poland and stuff were going, things are great in Germany. They pay your medical, they pay your dental. You get beautiful facilities to live in, beautiful bunks. They pay you the same as a German citizen in equal work. You know, their farm days aren't terrible. You get to actually sleep and take breaks and stuff. You're coming with me. And so they'd bring friends over, and the Germans are going, okay, you can't just bring anybody over. Everyone has to be accounted for and documented. So even Germany during the war, when things weren't as stringent, had the illegal and just basic immigration problems where so many people were flooding in. Now, this should tell us right away that A, Jews weren't sneaking around trying to avoid terror. And number two, was security really as tight as we think in NS Germany during the war? No, obviously not.
Right.
And of course, you can't uphold the slave argument. These were not slaves. They could voluntarily leave.
Right. And Hollywood.
They stayed during bombing raids and helped clean up.
Right. And Hollywood would have us believe that everybody had to show their papers to the Gestapo and
No, they didn't. Yeah, the Gestapo and SS helped Jews more than anything, and even during the Kristallnacht.
Right.
You know, Jews were going to the Gestapo and stuff for protection. You know, we've been lied to on all this stuff, so... You know, we got to just shed those lies. It's in Beckert's book somewhere. I don't know if I can quite find that one. And just incidentally, the Mossad and the Gestapo worked together, but it wasn't the Mossad we know today. This was the, basically the Mossad was kind of an organization in charge of kind of transfer agreement, emigration, getting Zionist inclined Jews to want to emigrate. So it became the intelligence arm of Israel once it was a state, but the Mossad was strictly just a training organization for emigration prior to. And so they don't have any argument. They can just forget it. They can really forget it as far as their, the horror that they were undergoing. It just didn't happen. Here it is right here. She says, when during the so-called Kristallnacht in November 1938, the Jewish emigration center on Berlin's Meineke Straße was damaged, it was the SS that sent a team to clean up and to ensure that the office would be functioning again as soon as possible. And of course, Leopold Edler von Mildenstein went to Palestine in 1934, stayed there for half a year, wrote a book about it, which was then featured in Goebbels' Der Angriff in 1934, talking about whether Palestine was habitable for Jews, what kind of situation is it politically, how do people feel, what kind of place is it culturally, etc. And before people go, see, I told you, Hitler founded Israel. Yeah. He was Mr. Jew. He was Mr. Jutsi. No. It's far more complicated than that. The whole world, no one wanted Jews. They all met at Avion No, we don't want Jews. We're so sad about the horror and the terror they're undergoing, but we can't do anything to help them. Okay. No one wanted them. No one. And so Hitler's like, okay, where am I going to send these people? I want them out. It's so.
And it wasn't.
Pretty much just Palestine, which was Britzy. It was Britzy at the time. It was not Arab. So we need to understand that.
Right. And they wanted Germany wanted to get rid of their Jews very early. It wasn't just something that Hitler thought about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so did other countries of the world. Poland and France were in on the Madagascar plan. Supported emigration. Poland wanted their Jews out, too. Now, it was the Allies' coalition, namely the Britzies and their little lap dogs all over the world. I'll just reuse the Britzy Anglo-Saxons. Okay, they made it impossible for the Madagascar plan to work. So they forced the Germans to take that Palestine route. There are many other machinations behind this that are covered in Albion and Zion United by Wolf Christian Meyer. That's going to be published. It'll be out next year, January. So this book, definitive, you will absolutely see straight from the Reich, straight from their governments and officials' own words. Now, we were not founders of Palestine, etc. And it's Werner von Hentig. Is that his name? Yeah. See that book from here. He was a foreign ambassador. He told the Irgun, the Stern gang, if you will, the Irgun terrorists, you know, it's really great that you want to help Germany so much and that you're willing to fight on our side. And believe you me, Irgun was ready to go the mile for Germany. They were going to fight against Britain, terrorist attacks, kill those Anglo-Saxons in Palestine, if you just give us Palestine.
Right.
Okay. And Hentig said, I can't do that. What would our Arab friends say? So right there, you have an official ambassador telling the Irgun, can't do that. I'd love to. Man, it's tempting, but I can't do that because of our Arab. We've got to, you know, work with the Arabs too.
Right.
So there you have it right there. No, Hitler wasn't founder of Israel, Mr. Jutzi. Because Hitler would have had Stern in his office.
Right.
I mean, he armed and trained Irgun if that was what he wanted.
Certainly. And Kaiser Wilhelm told them the same thing back in 1897.
Right. Yep. And according to the INS figures, now getting back to this Operation Wetback, now these figures can't be confirmed and neither can the figures for Jewish emigration, though Ingrid cites the Wannsee Protocol, which is about 500... I think it was about 537,000. But according to the INS figures of the United States, we deported about as many Mexicans as Hitler did Jews in their entirety in 1 year.
Oh, my.
52, we deported 500,000 Mexicans, either forcibly or coerced them through a media blitz. Which the Jews say that kind of media blitz against them was terror and horror and discrimination. Well, then it's the same thing in America against the Mexicans and got them to leave. So I can just go through kind of the steps of Operation Wetback real quick before we run. Okay, well, a wall was proposed, but they shot that down because it was too expensive and it really wasn't a good deterrent, according to the government. They then proposed airlifting Mexicans and dropping them off in Mexico, but that's too expensive too. Those aircraft sure cost a lot. How about federal troops? No, that would anger the Mexican government and sour our Latin American relations who we need to exploit and stuff. So that doesn't work. Brownell even suggested shooting some as a deterrent to others, which already occasionally happened. Yeah, let's just shoot maybe, you know, a couple hundred or so, and hopefully that'll be a good deterrent. This was actually proposed by the Attorney General.
Oh, my.
Or after our war of liberation of Europe. Joseph Swing was appointed Commissioner of Immigration in 1954. He was renowned as a quote-unquote Mexican hater. That's a great guy to put in charge of the Commission of Immigration.
Perfect person.
Yeah, whereas Adolf Eichmann spoke Hebrew, liked Jews generally. You know, he kind of said, you know, I see the Zionists kind of want their own state like we do. They're all into their folk and kind of support them. He was actually friendly towards Jews and even had Jewish friends as a young man, whereas we put this Mexican hater in charge.
And then look what happened to Eichmann.
Yeah, look at what happened to Eichmann in Jerusalem. Wasn't even laid to rest peacefully. He had to be scattered out in the ocean as a set of ashes so that he'd never find rest. That's why they did that.
Oh my.
Because Jews have a thing about the sea that it never lets you rest when they scatter you out to sea. Other peoples have different ideas, but that's a very nasty thing to do. Hitler didn't throw your ashes all over in the sea.
Yeah, he put them in little urns and gave them to the family.
Yeah, for those Jews who did perish in the camps from heart disease, malnutrition, whatever, they were cremated. Their ashes were put in beautiful little urns that were handmade and given to the families.
Yes.
Oh, horror. Gosh, we were really hiding our extermination plan. Yeah. Incredible. Incidentally, Swing met with Eisenhower without an appointment, bypassed any formalities and red tape, and got what he wanted and needed for Operation Wetback. Simply went to Eisenhower and said, I need this, this, and this. And Ike said, okay, no need for Congress, etc. No need to consult the people, none of that. Now, we always lambast Hitler for having Goering and other NS officials come to him personally and bypass red tape. But it's okay if our guys do it. We're just streamlining.
Sure.
No, this happens in any government. There's always those officials that get favoritism. It's just part of human nature. And it's okay as long as they're not, you know, creatures of exploitation.
Right. Like Matilda Krim with Johnson.
Right. Exactly.
She wasn't even an official.
As long as it's not a Jutsi or an AIPAC lobbyist, we're okay with a streamlining process. We're a grower. Okay, so Operation Wetback was a military operation. So here we have our police military state, martial law, conducted by retired and active military officials going on our soil, raiding companies without warrants, busting in private homes, taking people out of their cars on the side of the road. It all happened, 1954. In fact, it started in May. That was the beginning of the planning. And then the first phase was the media onslaught, get them to leave on their own with hostile coverage in the media, name-calling, racism, that kind of stuff. It was pretty rampant. They were known as wetbacks and illegals. They weren't even human. Second, create favorable publicity for deportation. So, you know, you had all this media going, yeah, deportation, let's, you know, whip up a fervor for that so Americans support the coming martial law we're going to implement, basically. Third, wide publicity to avoid surprise and criticism, also known as transparency, and to make it look like we're going to be as humane as possible. Look, we're openly telling you about the martial law and the police tactics we're coming out with and the militarism. And also to save money by voluntary departures. So, you know, the whole point of this pre-campaign was to get as many Mexicans to leave as possible. But again, we must think, they just come here, they've been exploited and treated horribly, living in filthy, horrible places, exploited by these growers, charged exorbitant rates for anything they needed, threatened all the time, like, if you say anything, if you report the abuse going on here, you're out of here. This stuff was going on all the time, okay? Now you're being kicked out of the country. And so we got to kind of think about that. This did not happen in NS Germany. The Jews were never subjected to this kind of arbitrary, horrible, inhuman treatment. Yeah, they got discrimination. Yeah, they got some racism, but it was not on par with this. And they were not simply thrown out and dropped off in foreign countries and made to fend for themselves. with nothing. So we need to keep that in mind. It officially started on June 10th, 1954. The California-Arizona plan, you know, portion of the plan was first. That was the bus lifting to train. And then, of course, it was about 1,000 a day. So, of course, we can take the numbers, the figures that Garcia puts out, and compare those to Crystal Knight and the Holohoax. And you're going to see that, no, the Germans couldn't possibly have done that with those kind of figures.
Right.
Comparison to this very real documented operation here. And much later with even better technology and resources and stuff. So, you know, the Mexican government was cooperative. They didn't want their citizens running across the border. So they were ready to pick up to 1,000 a day by train. And then they took them to the interior. Cooperation of the local law enforcement officials and stuff was essential. And of course, the police were running around grabbing any Mexican, including many times citizens who protested, "I'm a citizen. I've been here for like 20 years. What are you doing?" You know, slap that guy in the face. "You be quiet. Don't talk to me. You're going to the INS or whatever." Picked up and deported a lot of them.
Oh, my goodness. So
if they didn't have their papers on them right there, like, yeah, anyone carries around a birth certificate with them. Sometimes you got deported with the illegals. And the holding centers were concentration camps, and they weren't too pretty. Of course, the INS picked you up from there. Real quick, two facts that are just side issues. Interesting to note, though, in the light of the fact that the growers were screaming about how they were desperate for this labor, most of the illegal workers who were apprehended during Operation Wetback were unemployed.
Really? Okay.
Why aren't you working for the growers who were screaming for you 2 weeks ago? Yeah, the growers want to use them.
And abuse them and then dispose of them.
Then let the taxpayer pick it up. Yeah, it's incredible. And most growers did not want these people as legal braceros because they found enough local laborers. So now they're going, "We don't want them as braceros, so don't bother bringing them back. We're hiring local labor." Wait a minute, I thought you couldn't do that. You couldn't afford it.
Amazing.
Now that they're threatened with a fine in prison for hiring illegals, they're hiring locals. Incredible. So don't ever believe the growers. They're lying. Small farmers, probably telling the truth. Agribusiness, they're lying. So suddenly the growers were supportive of the deportation of illegals they formerly couldn't live without. On June 10th, 2,000 illegals have been apprehended by 11 p.m. that night. So I say, compared to the inane hoax and Crystal Knight claims of the Jews, it took all day until 11 p.m. at night with all the, like, over 700 officers just nonstop apprehending, and they only gathered about 2,000.
Oh, really?
Germans were gassing 2,000 an hour.
Well, you know how efficient the Germans are. They probably had a better way.
Efficiency. So netting about 2,000 per day, though, between June 17th and July 26th, only 4,403 were apprehended in the L.A. operation. 52,374 total apprehensions and expellations had occurred by the end of the drive on July 27th in the California operation. And so, of course, there was a mixed reaction from the growers, social justice and civil rights groups, and the public. Some said it was vicious, un-American, discriminatory, and oppression of a minority group. They opposed the concentration camps to hold the deportees and said they were inhuman. Unfortunately, they compared them to the German camps. And it's like, you guys, the Allies caused that.
Right. Okay?
Not how they were before the bombing. So, of course, the INS claimed that 540,000 were expelled or left due to pressure. And interestingly enough, the GI Forum and the League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC, supported the drive in Texas. They did not want illegals because these Mexican citizens saw them as undercutting their own families, and they were mostly migrant laborers. And so they didn't like the presence of illegals coming in and undercutting their salaries. So in the Texas operation, 41,951 were apprehended and 45,993 left voluntarily due to the pressure. The valley growers were forced by the government to contract legally. Now, it didn't happen 100%, but they became much better, and the Bracero program boasted much higher figures after Operation Wetback. So, of course, the government said it was a success. And I guess that's about it. Now, there were a couple incidents that happened. One was when a border patrol man got too close to an individual and actually sheared his head off wing of his aircraft. And he was all distraught about that. But, you know, that was a total accident. But again, it happens. In the media, the liberal media went insane over that. You know, of course, they did the same thing with Germany. You know, we had some catastrophic deaths in some of those concentration camps where, you know, people were starving, etc. And of course, the liberal media blew it up.
Sure.
You know, these things were actually caused by the war situation itself, Allied bombing. You know how it is. Incidents
sure.
happen. There was also one other in 1956 during the boat lifting. Now this, you know, yes, it started in 54 and was still going in 56. To Veracruz, 7 had jumped overboard and drowned. So, of course, there was major public outcry in the U.S. and Mexico, and it ended right then and there. So, really not that many benefits to the American people, because Garcia goes, okay, well, the government claimed success and say the government or the Americans got jobs from it, government saves money, etc. But they were a little misleading, because a lot of these people did end up coming back. Or what we did is we spent a ton of money on this operation only to have these people legalized through the Bracero program. So what was the point? Why spend all this money just to stop some really loudmouth activist growers? Because that's basically what they did.
Right.
And the INS claims they got 1,500,000 total illegal immigrants to leave. So, you know,
wow.
That's not proven though. But if it's true, if that is anywhere near correct, Hitler only got 537,000 Jews out of Germany if we accept the Wannsee number. And we deported many, well, what, three times that number almost?
Yes.
So who's the real?
Yeah.
Inhuman, you know, and like I said, many Mexicans died. They died of rattlesnake bites. They were dropped off in the middle of deserts.
There's no water. No shelter.
Right. They just, you know, when we started this early on, we just dropped them off, and wherever you ended up, that's where you were. So that never happened to Jews.
Wow.
And of course, anybody can get Jewish Emigration from the Third Reich by Ingrid Veckert on Amazon. It's like a $8 book.
Right.
Cheap, quick read. And it gives you pretty much everything.
Yeah. I have it as a PDF file.
Yeah. It's great. It's wonderful.
It is. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah. And of course, Weizsäcker was the one who was trying to sabotage the transfer agreement stuff by not telling Hitler what was being proposed by Ruble, that George Ruble, who was trying to work out a plan to get Jews to emigrate to other parts of the world, not just Palestine. This was for everywhere else.
Right.
Palestine. Weizsäcker made sure Hitler never heard about that man or his proposal. Interesting. Weizsäcker was an anti-Hitler conspirator.
Imagine.
Yeah. So what a horrible human being. He sure didn't help Jutsis, that's for sure.
That is amazing. And this is an amazing comparison. Mm-hmm. And it's one that I think needed to be made. And you did it. That is amazing.
Yeah. And I mean, if people want to get Operation Wetback, it's an outstanding book. It's really expensive, though, because the thing is just totally obsolete. I had to pay $60 for my copy, and that was cheap.
Oh, yeah, it's $112.95.
Yeah, Juan Ramon Garcia. It's the only thing I've found that's official and well-documented on that. And, man, he gets into some real good details and stuff, and it's an eye-opener.
Right. There are some used copies for $77, but...
It's not too bad.
Not too bad.
And, of course, I know that a lot of people say it was mainly the Jews who pushed immigration. Now, that may be on the legal front.
Right.
But illegal, that's going to be your growers, whoever the growers are.
Yes. And, of course, I mean, the growers, they borrowed their money from the bankers in order to grow their crops. So if you, you know, look at the whole apparatus and see who the growers went to for immigration policy change, it's just kind of interesting.
Yeah, the cycle of madness.
Yeah.
And quick, I thought it was funny that some official, like it was one of our government officials, he said something like, the government's job, it's not the government's duty to make jobs. Not when you're Hitler.
Yes.
The government's duty is to make jobs. That's the only reason it exists if you're Hitler and a National Socialist.
Right.
Because all you care about as the government in the state is to create an existence for your people.
Right. To benefit everybody. Not just one branch, not just one group of people, but to benefit all the folk.
Right. And Hitler was a redistributionist. He did redistribute the wealth, but that doesn't mean there weren't wealthy people in the Reich. Of course there were.
Right.
Everyone was just better off and happier.
Right. And had a job and had a car and it was good.
Right. So that's what I'd say to those who go, why would we want an NS government? So compare it to this.
Indeed. Oh, my word. Oh, my word. When you look at all the programs, I mean, our healthcare system, it's a sickness industry, and it's designed to basically poison everyone.
Right.
For profit, though.
Yeah, it's terrible here.
Yes.
And if you're uninsured, don't let anyone fool you. The uninsured healthcare is so bad. I've actually gone through it before. Few years ago when I was uninsured, it's not pretty. It's a nightmare. They treat you will die.
Yes.
You will. If you have something debilitating, if you have cancer, you're written off by the uninsured healthcare system that's supposed to be so great for these illegals and minorities and stuff. Don't let them fool you. It isn't pretty. It's horrible too. It's horrible.
Sure. And it isn't about more healthcare. It's about more insurance. They're not increasing the number of hospitals or the doctors or anything.
Right.
It's like car insurance.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, the taxpayers really are paying for the bare minimum service for people who are uninsured and going to Medicaid and stuff.
Sure.
They're getting such substandard care. It's really bad.
And I think there's a limit I think it's like $5,000 that they will pay.
Yeah, exactly. So if you have cancer or something, they'll let you die. You're going to die. So people who have insurance or who resent Medicaid, et cetera, just know that.
Right.
Those people don't have it made.
Right.
So, yeah. And plus, you have to wait a long time just to even qualify. They put you through every hoop, make you print out all your bank, everything you own, they want to know.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. Every cent. And you have to sign a lien so that if you ever do come into money, the government can seize it to pay your bill.
Right.
So you're on the hook as an uninsured person using state care.
And if you run out of money and you're in a nursing home, well, out you go.
Oh, yeah. They'll kick you right on the street.
Yep.
So, yeah, this is why we would want an NS government.
Yes.
So.
Well, thank you so very much for all of your research efforts and your presentation, and thanks for everything you do. I look forward to your upcoming books and our next visit.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful, and unfortunately, don't have as much time as normal for the radio shows, but hope to have that change.
Okay, well,
yes. These books are out.
Yes.
But we'll have another one in the future here, hopefully kind of soon.
Okay. We'll arrange that. All righty.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.